Today is Monday, January 23rd. We're going to wrap up inorganic compound information, and then we'll cover organic compounds today. All right, so why don't we start electrolytes today? They're going to be found on the top of page 15. So let's do a little bit of review. Last Wednesday, we talked about two types of bonds. We talked about covalent bonds and ionic bonds. Can you tell me one difference between the two? Good. Covalent share electrons, covalent bonds share electrons, right? Ionic bonds transfer electrons. So the whole goal with either of those is to achieve a stable what?
Balance shell.
Balance shell, good. That outermost orbital, that valence shell, good. So the catch is with ionic bonds, you end up transferring one or more electrons. Now, when you do that, you no longer have neutral atoms. Instead, what you create are what? Cations and anions. Good. Can you tell me which one of those has given away one or more electrons?
Cations.
Cations, good. And what charge does a cation carry?
Positive.
Good. So that means anions have a
negative
charge, meaning what?
They
took an electron. Good. So you've kind of got a reason to hang around the neighbor because you've got an electron or more in common that you have transferred between the two of you to get a stable valence shell. So that's kind of where I want your brain right now is thinking in terms of ionic bonds, because when we look at electrolytes, they are considered inorganic, which means they don't have long chains of carbons and hydrogens, but they're also considered to be ionic compounds. That's, of course, the transfer that took place to create a stable valence shell. So when you put a compound that's ionically held together in water, that compound tends to break apart. And the word dissociate means to break apart, okay? So if you put an ionic compound like table salt in water, and you give the water a little bit of a stir, what happens to the sodium and chloride atoms? They kind of dissolve, don't they? So they've broken up. No longer do you have little tiny cubes of salt crystals. Those salt crystals break up and they dissolve, and what you get in that water is now sodium ions and chlorine ions or chloride ions. So that's what we're thinking of here. These electrolytes are technically ionically bonded and they break up or dissociate into their ions, cat and anions. Now in this category, we've got a lot of chemicals. Acids fall in this category, bases and salts. And I don't want you to think of table salt here, because I don't know about you, but that's the first thing that pops in my mind is table salt. Now that is a salt, but that's just one of many different kinds of salts that fall in this category of electrolytes. So what do they all have in common? Acids, bases, and salts. What do they have in common? There's very little carbon or hydrogen, right? They dissolve in water. That means they break up or break apart. And when they break up, what do they break up into? Cations and anions. Good, good. So the whole goal here is to appreciate that acids, bases, and salts are electrolytes, which means that they are ionically bonded together and break up into their ions when dissolved in water.
Break up into ions.
And yeah, dissolve is another way to think of them. Okay, let me give you an example. Stomach acid is made of hydrogen chloride. And when stomach acid combines with water, what happens to the hydrogens and the chlorines? They break apart, yeah. And so what you have are cations and anions, right? And so they can conduct electricity. Thus, the name electrolyte is based on the fact that these ions can conduct electricity. So when you think about that, it kind of opens your mind to saying, oh, wow. parts of our bodies can conduct electricity, and yeah, absolutely. That's how nerves work, that's how muscles work, you know, that's how we send messages from our brain to our body parts to move. So the fact that these ions are essentially electrolytes kind of opens our eyes to understanding the electrical conduction power of these chemicals, acids and bases and salts. Let's see, some common ones that we're going to run into in both Bio-210 and 211 are things like sodium. What does that little plus sign there indicate?
Cation.
Good, you're right. It's a positive charge. It is, in fact, a cation. Does that mean it's lost or received electrons?
It gave away
electrons. Calcium with a 2 plus there indicates that it gave away 2 electrons. That's why there's a 2 there. And so that one is also considered a cation. Potassium, K plus, again, another cation. That plus charge indicates we gave away 1 electron. And magnesium, another one with a positive charge, it too gave away a single electron. Now, these are some common anions. Chlorine, notice it has a negative charge there. What does that indicate has happened?
It
receives an electron. Good. And then there's some more complex ones. These are called like polyatomic anions. You'll notice there's multiple elements listed here. Bicarbonate has a hydrogen, a carbon, and an oxygen. And again, that group has a negative charge, so it too receives at least 1 electron. And then our last one down there, phosphate. Phosphate's common in our DNA, our RNA, and ATP molecules. It too receives at least a negative charge from that electron that's transferred. So these are ones that we're going to discuss throughout this course and through Bio-211. Anybody still need this slide? So a couple of really important functions for electrolytes include osmosis and staying hydrated. So you may have heard that if you have vomiting and diarrhea, it's important to maintain balance with your electrolytes. What are some drink choices that you can put into your body that are good electrolyte sources?
Gatorade,
good. Pedialyte. Okay, is tap water a good source of electrolytes?
No.
So very few ions like sodium and potassium in something like tap water. You know, chicken broth is a good source of electrolytes if you choose to drink that. But you're right, Gatorade, Pedialyte, something that has ions in it like sodium and potassium are good sources to replenish those that are lost. Muscle and nerves, like we mentioned, are going to depend on you having electrolytes in your body. That's how we send nerve impulses and messages to control our bodies. Anyone still need this slide? Good. So our first category is the salt category. And like I mentioned, you know, our minds first go to table salt. Table salt is sodium chloride, but that's just one example of salts in this category. They are considered inorganic compounds, and what that means is they lack long chains of carbons and what? Hydrogens. Yeah. No long chains of carbons and hydrogens. They are ionically bonded together, which means that they are not neutral atoms anymore. Instead, we now have ions.
No long chains of what?
No long chains of carbons and hydrogens. Best for salt, yeah. You'll notice that salts also don't contain hydrogens, which is the H plus here, or OH minus, which is known as hydroxide or hydroxyl. Long chains of hydrogen and carbon.
The hydrogen and then the...
Yeah, the hydrogen, the hydroxyl is the OH. covered that list of common electrolytes. I think you'll notice several familiar examples here. NaCl is table salt, that's sodium chloride. KCl is potassium chloride. Sometimes it's marketed as no salt. NaSO4 is sodium sulfate. So we're starting to see there's a routine pattern here. There are not long chains of hydrogens and carbons, which helps us to eliminate these as organic compounds. They're more or less neutral, yeah. They're not going to be acid nor base, you're right.
What was the last one?
Sodium sulfate. Moves us along into the acids and bases, and the acids and bases are going to be our next major category. So the acids and bases are related to, due to their nature of what they release. Let's take the acids first. You'll notice that they tend to release hydrogen ions more than hydroxyls when they're dissolved in water. So when you place an acid like, say, stomach acid in water, it's going to break apart into its ions, the cations and anions. Okay. So examples in our bodies include things like stomach acid. What are some other examples of acids in the body? Vaginal fluids, good. Saliva, good.
Urine.
Urine, yes, urine's another one. So we've got so far stomach acids, vaginal fluids, saliva, urine. Interesting, even your skin is acidic. You know, the oils that are secreted onto your skin surface, they are also acid in nature. Okay. So you'll notice that acids release hydrogen ions in solution. Bases, by contrast, release a different chemical, and that's an O and an H together. That O and H, or oxygen and hydrogen, are called hydroxide or hydroxyl. So bases release hydroxide or hydroxyl in solution. NaOH is an example that I've given you there on your paper. You'll notice they break apart into sodium and the hydroxide ion. So which one of those two products is going to be your cation? Let's do it that way.
Sodium.
Na is your sodium. That's your cation. Good. How did you know?
Positive charge.
Positive charge, good. Okay, how about some examples of bases in the human body? Semen, blood,
pancreatic juice
is good. Okay, so we've got semen, blood, pancreatic juices. That's a pretty good list. You won't forget it that way.
Right.
Okay, so tell me about the pH scale. First off, what is the pH scale? Awesome, good. Measure of how many hydrogen ions you have in solution. Hydrogen ions. That's what the H and pH stands for, right? Okay, the H stands for the hydrogen ion concentration in a solution.
Repeat that again?
What's that?
Repeat that.
Sure. It's the measure of how many hydrogen ions you have in solution.
Oh, okay.
Okay. What is the lowest number on the pH scale?
Zero.
Zero, right? Not one. Zero is your lowest number. What is your highest number?
14.
Good. So your scale runs from 0 to 14. What is number 7? What's special?
Neutral.
Meaning what?
Water.
Okay. So if you think about water, water is H2O. And in solution, water, of course, could break apart and give us hydrogen ions and hydroxyl ions. So it's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense because, of course, acids come from the H side of the house, the hydrogen ions, and bases come from the OH side of the house. So at 7.0, water releases equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyls.
So to be neutral, you have equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyls?
That's correct. At a pH of 7.
At a pH of 7.
Water releases equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyl. Okay, so at 7, water is technically neutral. That's 7.0, meaning that that water molecule releases equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyl ions. So nowhere else in the pH scale do we see an even amount of those two ions being released.
So water's it.
Water's it, yeah. They say tears are kind of neutral, but I think that most textbooks will say they're somewhat acidic. Yeah, something like 6.9, 6.8, so they're a little slightly acidic. Not that we would notice the difference, you know?
Unless you taste
it. Yeah, refreshing.
Well, I was thinking if you cry enough, it stings, so that would help you remember this a tiny little bit.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. So tell me where the acids are on the pH scale.
6.9.
Make it really easy. It's below 7, right? And then above 7 is what?
Base.
So you can simply make it just pretty easy and say, hey, anything below 7 is an acid. Anything above 7 is a base. So technically 6.9 all the way down to 0 is considered acidic, and 7.1 is a base all the way up to 14. Where are your strongest acids and bases located?
Closer to the end.
To the end, it's good. So 0 is going to be your strongest acid. What's your strongest base number?
14.
14, good. Anything around that neutral area is considered not strong, but...
Weak.
Okay. So let's talk about what it means to be strong versus weak. We know what it means muscular-wise, right? Okay. So if you're talking about a strong acid versus a weak acid, strong acids can release more hydrogen ions. Weak acids release what? Less. Yeah. So a strong acid is one that is more willing to give up its hydrogens. A weak acid is less willing to give away its hydrogens. Or break up in water. Interesting, stomach acid's pretty strong. It's about 1 or 2 on the pH scale. That is so incredibly strong that, you know, if it was sitting out in the environment, we would say, oh, don't touch it, that's stomach acid. You know, you've often heard, don't touch battery acid, it can like burn you. Stomach acid is just as strong. So you think about what sitting down there in the pit of your stomach churning up food is really, really insanely strong acid. So strong that it can make Swiss cheese holes in your esophagus. It can literally make, you know, holes, and it can also erode away your tooth enamel. That's how strong of an acid stomach acid is. Really welcomes giving up its hydrogen ions, very freely gives them away. Something that's less strong is saliva. You'll notice it's up there closer to, say, somewhere between 6 and 7. So it's not going to give away its hydrogens as freely as stomach acid. So, yeah, you can have saliva in your mouth and not worry about it like making all your teeth fall out. At least that's the hope, right? Not a whole lot of bases in our bodies, but you know, we do make ammonia, something similar, in our urine. And so you'll notice that's on the base or alkaline end of your pH scale. Have you heard that word before, alkaline? Okay. Well, and that would be basic water. Yeah. So I just want to make sure you heard the word alkaline because it's an alternate term for base. So alkaline or basic, same thing. It's on the upper end of that pH scale. Let's hit the pH scale fast facts at the bottom of your page. Let's see, we've covered most of that. Let's hit the fifth bullet point down that says the pH scale is based on logarithms. Here it's based on the number 10. That means a change from one whole number to the next whole number is a tenfold change in either acidity or alkalinity on the pH scale. And before your brain gets ahead of you, it's not going to be adding, it's going to be a multiplicative process, right? That's a big word, a multiplicative process. So if I move from 6 to 5, it's a tenfold change. If I move from 6 to 4, it's now a 100-fold change. So we never add the powers here, we actually multiply the powers. So that tells me a pH of 4 releases 100 times more what than a pH of 6?
Hydrogens.
Yeah. Is 4 stronger than 6 or weaker than 6? It's stronger, yeah. So a pH of 4 releases 100 times more hydrogens than a pH of 6. What's the difference between 5 and 6? 10. So how many times weaker is 6 than 5?
10.
10 times weaker, right. How many times stronger is 6 than 7?
10.
Also 10, good. So you can cross that boundary. You can even say 6 is how many times stronger than 8?
100.
It's 100. So which one of these releases 100 times more hydrogens?
It's 6.
6. Which one of these releases 100 times more hydroxyl?
Like
8. 8, yeah. So you can do the conversation even across that strange no man's land that occurs right there at 7.
So acids means hydrogen.
Hydrogens, that's right. That's right. Good. Let's see. At the bottom of your page, you've got a few to fill out, but let me give you a really easy way to do this. Okay, so when you start moving 3 and 4 paces on this pH scale, that gets to be a little, you know, tricky because you can lose pace of where you're at. So let's say you're comparing urine or even coffee with a pH of 6 compared to a pH of 3. What's the shortcut way to do this to determine the amount of hydrogens released? Well, let's see. If I want to know the difference between 6 and 3, you got it, yeah. So just do a subtraction. If you're comfortable working with exponents, it's technically 10 to the power of 3 difference, or you're right, that 3 tells me how many zeros I need to work with. There is, in fact, 1,000 times more hydrogens released by a pH of what? There's 1,000 times more hydrogens released by which of these two pHs?
3.
3, good. Let's flip-flop the wording. There's 1,000 times less hydrogens released by pH of?
6.
6, right. But you can also use your base language, your hydroxide language. You can say a pH of 6 releases 1,000 times more hydroxides than 3. And before I blow your mind, you're going, wait a minute, this is an acid, right? Acids don't release hydrogens, right? But there's a continuum here. So in fact, bases and acids can release a little bit of each. It's just that bases release more hydroxides and acids release more what? Hydrogens. Yeah. So even though you're at a pH of 6, and technically that would be considered an acid, you're getting pretty darn close to the base side of the scale. So you could say that we are releasing 1,000 times more hydroxides than you are for a pH of 3. Okay, so that gets a little into kind of tricky territory, doesn't it, to use that kind of language. Let me give you a moment. There are 4 problems at the bottom of your page, and there are maybe 3. Let me give you a moment to fill in the blanks for those three practice problems at the very bottom of your page. Doing head, yeah. This is the only thing you're going to have to do. If you can subtract, that's probably the best way to do it, and then you've got your zero number. A pH of 2 releases how many more hydrogens than 5?
1,000.
1,000, good. So I'm just checking to make sure you don't say something like 30, because we're not adding, right? We're multiplying. Let's see, a pH of 3 releases how many more less hydroxyls than 7?
10,000.
10,000, good. So there should be 4, zeros there on your number. That's what we're looking for. And then finally, a pH of 5 releases 1,000 times more what?
Hydrogen.
Okay, so 5 is closer to the acid end of your pH scale, so it's going to release more hydrogens. It's more acidic than a pH of 7. Let me give you another one about kind of in those same lines of wording, that last one. Let's say an 11. 11 releases how many more hydroxyls than 8? 11 more than 8? 1,000, right? Okay. Are you releasing more hydroxyls than 11 or more hydrogens than 11?
Hydroxyls.
Good. How did you know hydroxyls?
Because it's a higher base.
It's a higher base, but you're going toward that 14, which is your absolute strongest base.
So
it's
1,000, correct?
It's 1,000, that's right. Let's do another one. Let's say 1 compared to 5. 1 is stronger than 5 because 1 releases more what?
Okay. Hydrogen.
Hydrogen is good. How do you know? Good. It's a lower number. It's more acidic. In fact, it's pretty strongly acidic at that low end of the scale. Okay. How do you feel about this page of acids and bases? Pretty good? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and flip on over to page 16. Oops, page 17. Let's take a look there. Just want to briefly give you 3 different kinds of chemical reactions. The first one at the top of your page is called a neutralization reaction. And on the second page, we're going to talk about 2 other kinds. They are endergonic, exergonic, and metabolic reactions. This is kind of laying the foundation for your conversation throughout both Bio-210 and 211. To start off with, a neutralization reaction is one that occurs between an acid and a base. Good, you got it. Acid and a base. Let me give you some shortcut knowledge so you can work with some basic chemistry. When you look at something like NaOH, that OH is screaming, I am a base, right? That is a huge, awesome clue, because in water, that base is going to break up into the sodium, and there's your hydroxide. So the OH at the end of the chemical compound is a fantastic clue you've got a base. How do you know that HCl is an acid? Hydrogen, right. When you put this one in water, the hydrogen breaks up from the chlorine, and then, of course, you've got hydrogen and chloride ions. So, yeah, use those built-in clues to help you learn, whether you've got an acid or a base. One really big exception to the rule is water, right? Water is not acid nor base. It's what?
Neutral.
It's neutral, all right. So when you have an acid and a base react, as you do here, what you end up with on the product side of the chemical reaction are water and salt. All right, so we know H2O is water. That's an easy one to spot, but salt, NaCl, might not be so easy to spot. What you have to do is go through a mental checklist. You'll notice it doesn't have lots of hydrogens and carbons, so we can say it's not an organic compound. Another thing to do is to say, hey, are there any hydrogens in that particular compound? Nope. How about hydroxides or hydroxyls? Not that either. So if you run through your checklist, you can eliminate NaCl as organic, you can eliminate it as not being an acid, and you can also say it's not a base. So what you're looking for are long chains of hydrogens and carbons to say it's organic. It doesn't have those, so you can say it's not an organic compound. No hydrogens means it's not a what?
Acid.
Not an acid. No hydroxides means it's not a
base.
So you kind of have nothing left to choose but it being a salt. Okay?
So, quick question.
Sure, go ahead.
If this was a test, what would be the options? Like, what, if you were to give us a test, would you say, is this a asset base or gain or earn credit?
I might give you this reaction, and I'll say, take a look at NACL, and I'll say, determine what it is, and I'll give you, like you said, acid, base, organic, inorganic, salt. It technically is inorganic, and it's also a salt.
And how do you come up with inorganic?
It doesn't have long chains of hydrogens and carbons. If it had lots of hydrogens and carbons, I'd say, oh, it's organic in nature. But since it doesn't have those, I have to put it into this inorganic category. Bases don't have long chains of hydrogens. Bases just have one or two, acids don't have long chains of, there's only one or two hydrogens. I'll show you a chemical compound called a fat that has like 20 hydrogens hooked to it.
Okay, so it has to have like a fat really, really high.
Yes.
So 2 and 3 is not a long chain.
That's right. 2 and 3 could be an acid technically.
And organic is a long chain.
Long chain, yeah. I'm assuming that you guys understand what reactants and products are. Do you understand what side of the reaction here is the reactants? The base and the acid, yeah. They're on the left side of the reaction. And what do you call this stuff on the right side?
Products.
Okay. And for our purposes in bio, I'm always going to use the arrow pointing toward the right, which makes life so much easier for us because that means the reactants are always on the left and the arrow always points towards your products. Okay, so I'm just assuming you understand those terms. So this is where you're heading with this stuff. You may wonder why we spend so much time talking about acids and bases. It is a really big topic in Bio 211. In Bio 211, we talk about acid-base balance. And acid-base balance is critical for your blood pH. What is the narrow range for blood pH? Good. Highlight that. That's a number to know. Anything below 7.35 is going to be an acid, which is kind of weird, right? Because normally 7.2 is technically in base territory. So odd that 7.35 and below is technically considered acidosis, and anything above 7.45 is considered alkalosis, which makes sense because you're going in that alkaline direction on the pH scale. Okay, so these are going to be some really important features for us as we work through Bio 211. This is something we'll come back and hit on later on in that course. Also important for our conversation today are monomers and polymers. Can you tell me which one of these is a simple building block?
Monomer.
Monomer, good. How many units makes up a monomer?
One.
Just one. And what part of the word tells you one?
Mono.
Mono, good. What is a polymer?
Two or more.
Two or more, good. And of course, they're bonded or linked together in some way. So polymers are more complex than monomers. At the bottom of your page, let's just talk about energy in versus energy out of a chemical reaction. When you put energy into a chemical reaction, it is called an endergonic reaction. So this is the stuff that causes us a lot of energy input, right? Building a house, cleaning up your house, cleaning up your room, picking up and tidying any area is an endergonic activity. You have to put energy in order for you to get the job done. So in your body, when you're talking about building new muscle, building new cells, that's the whole reason we eat, and that is because we have to provide energy to make those processes happen. So how will you remember that endergonic means energy in?
Ender,
end. Ender, good. Ender is in, coming in. So you gotta have energy for these reactions that are building in nature. Sure.
A polymer and a monomer.
I guess the polymer is the single line, and the monomer is the plus sign.
I got Gotcha. Yeah, the polymer is this one because they are covalently bonded together. And this is a monomer, B is a monomer, and C, because you're right, they're being added together, so they're single pieces.
So if we see a plus sign, it would be a monomer because you're adding it. If you see the straight line, polymer because they're bonded.
That's one rule of thumb for it, yeah. Let's see, exergonic reactions on the very bottom of your page are energy out. In other words, energy is released from these chemical reactions. Now, these aren't building reactions, these are breakdown reactions. So when you're losing weight, when your body is breaking down and repairing, these kinds of breakdown reactions are technically called exergonic reactions.
An example of exergonic is like working out, right? Like building muscle?
Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Exergonic?
Yeah, exergonic would be, well, endergonic would be working out and building muscle. Exergonic is losing weight. So I think we all probably agree that it's much easier to make a mess than it is to clean one up. It takes far less energy to make a mess of your house than it does to clean up your house. So the process of breaking things down in your body is like making a mess, and that releases energy. That is an exergonic reaction. Cleaning up or building up or making is going to always be an endergonic reaction. How about questions on this page?
Would this be a picture type situation, or this is this, like, how do we ask the question?
Just words. I would put a picture for that. I would say if you require energy to make a chemical reaction run, energy input, then I'm kind of guiding you to think about endergonic, for instance. Same thing with the next page. I'd probably make a description rather than actual pictures for that stuff too. Okay. Let's leave activation energy for our discussion in enzymes. I'll come back and hit that term actually over a couple pages from now. Top of your next page has metabolism. You'll want to highlight the definition for metabolism. These are all the chemical reactions that make your body run. Everything from building reactions that require energy to breakdown reactions that release energy. We actually classify these into two different types. The building reactions are known as synthesis reactions or anabolic reactions. If you're from a chemistry background, they're sometimes called combination reactions. The opposite reactions are called, there are several different names. Decomposition is one. Hydrolysis is another, and of course, catabolic also means to break down. If you have trouble keeping these words straight, let me point out something. See the ana and the anabolism one? You've heard of anabolic steroids. They build up the muscle, right? So anabolic means to build. These are building compounds, building polymers. Obviously, cata is the opposite, so that is a breakdown reaction. Okay, I'm just checking to see if anybody still needs a slide. All right, so let's talk about anabolic reactions first. What is happening when you look at this chemical reaction for an anabolic reaction? What are you making? Polymers, right? So this is how your body builds whether it's building new muscle or new skin or even new hair, or let's say you got a paper cut and you're now knitting back together your epidermis. Anytime you build or make something in your body, you take building blocks known as monomers and you join them together to make a polymer. If you imagine taking train cars and linking one train car to another train car, this process of linking together is what we consider to be an anabolic process. Now there's one catch with this kind of process. You'll notice that there's another product down there besides the polymer. It's a water molecule. So let's kind of tie in why this is called a dehydration synthesis reaction. What happens to you when you're dehydrated? You lose water, right? And synthesis means to do what? To build up. Okay, to make or to build. So technically, dehydration synthesis means I am building polymers, and in doing so, I have to dehydrate the monomers and make water. So water is always going to be a product in one of your dehydration synthesis reactions.
Which means it's always going to be anabolic.
Always going to be anabolic, right. That is your best clue to look for. If you bake a cake, you put a sloppy mess in the oven. You know, eggs, milk, flour, sugar, all that stuff mixed together. It's runny. It's, you know, certainly not the final form. Put it in the oven for an hour, and what you pull out is going to be a dried out cake. And if you pay attention, you'll notice that when you open the oven door, steam hits you in the face, right? That steam was driven off when those monomers of flour and egg and milk were joined together to build the cake, which is now a polymer. So baking a cake is actually an example of a dehydration synthesis or anabolic reaction. Now, the next example I'm going to give you is not exactly spot on, but it gives you the right kinds of tools to think about. If you're exercising and you're sweating, what are you building? Muscle. And think of the sweat as being water lost while you build the muscle. Not exactly the right relationship there, but it gets us thinking in the right direction. When you're losing water from a chemical reaction, it allows you to join building blocks together and build. Okay, so exercising and sweating, kind of a good way to think about it too.
So you said we're losing water by a chemical reaction, we're building.
We're building, yeah. Have you ever heard we're supposed to drink something like 8 cups of water a day? Okay, so if you've ever heard some story like that, this is why catabolic reactions require water as a reactant, and that is the reason here is to help break down those polymers into monomers. If you're trying to lose weight, for instance, it's best to flood your diet with some water because that helps you to break down any fat or protein that you might be trying to get rid of. Nobody wants to get rid of protein, but nonetheless it happens. So if you're breaking down fat, then of course you have to have water to break apart the fat molecules to create monomers. So any kind of digestive process or breakdown process is considered to be catabolic. And if you think about the alternate name for this process, hydrolysis literally means what?
Lysis.
Yeah, lysis is to split water. And that's what we do. We use the water that we drink. We break down those food products, and then, of course, our bodies can use those for other purposes. So using the water that's in your diet is going to help you break down polymers into monomers. And if you don't drink, guess where you get the water from?
Your cells.
Your cells, yeah. And so then you're dehydrated, and then you've got this whole mess that follows. So it's good to put water in so that you can help break down those chemical polymers. So if you've ever had dirty dishes where you can't get stuck on food off the dirty dish, oftentimes we'll fill up a sink with water and let that sit overnight. Return the next morning and magic's occurred. All those food particles are gone. You've got brand new looking clean plates. So what did water accomplish for us overnight? Broke it down. Yeah, hydrolysis, good. So given enough time, water can break apart polymers into monomers. Water does this all the time in our bodies. It helps us to break down anything that we need to recycle and, of course, build anew. Do you have questions on those two chemical reactions? Okay, so where we're going now is organic compounds. Are worthy of flashcards. If you're a flashcards kind of person, I'd go ahead and work through all the organic compounds, stick the relevant information on the flashcards, and then you've got yourself a study guide set for next Wednesday's test. All these organic compounds have something in common. They contain carbons, hydrogens, oxygens, sometimes nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. We often see long chains of carbons and hydrogens, which makes them different from our inorganic molecules. Things like acids and bases. We do produce organic compounds, but sometimes they occur naturally in nature. And these compounds are also held together with covalent bonds. And so they often can be very large, and though, you know, they're still a compound, we oftentimes call them macromolecules because they're really big molecules. Our first one is carbohydrates, and of course carbohydrates are a great source of energy. The building block or monomer here is called the monosaccharide. Good. What is mono? And saccharide? Good. So our most important one is in fact glucose. We'll talk about that one in just a moment. These carbs give you some type of energy, whether it's a quick burst of energy or a longer burn of energy. How much energy they give you immediately depends on how many molecules are present in the carb. If you have monosaccharides, they're going to give you the quickest burst of energy. That stuff like candy, fruit, soft drinks fall into that monosaccharide and disaccharide category. If you need a longer burn of energy, something that lasts hours rather than minutes, pick something like a complex carb or a polysaccharide. Yeah, candy, fruit, soda, mono, and di. You know, these single lines here still represent single covalent molecules, but the catch to look for is they're put into a ring formation. So just notice that this time we have a ring instead of just a straight line. I like this particular picture of glucose because they've numbered the carbons for you. Right here we've got carbon number one, our second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth. To qualify as a monosaccharide, you need between three and how many?
Seven.
Three and seven carbons, okay? To qualify as a monosaccharide, you need between three and seven carbons. So the question is, does glucose qualify? Yeah, it's a good one. It's got six carbons, and that falls inside the 3 to 7 threshold. Glucose is an important one for us. It is our body's preferred fuel. This is how we make ATP. What is ATP?
Energy.
Good. So here's two ways to draw glucose. This is glucose on the left in a linear form. You can still count the six carbons that make up the long chain here. See, that doesn't look like an acid or a base, does it? There's long chains of carbons, hydrogens, hydroxyls, but there's long chains of carbons here. That's not what you find in those inorganic molecules like acids or bases. But glucose actually prefers to exist in a ring structure, and this is kind of the basis for organic chemistry, is looking at these organic molecules. Take a look at glucose and its really close buddy, galactose. They are both made up of the same numbers of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens. Now, the catch is, they're arranged slightly differently. They look almost identical, but notice the OH here and the H have been flip-flopped from glucose. Since they're flip-flop, we call them isomers. That means they have the same chemical formula, but they have a different chemical structure. Okay, isomers have the same chemical formula, just a different structure. Hey, isotopes have the same what? Same number of protons, but different numbers of
neutrons,
and a different
mass.
Good, good. So two really similar words, just two things to keep straight, right? Isotopes and isomers, two totally different things. Isomers have the same number of atoms in the chemical formula. They just happen to have a different structure. Yeah. Does your body know the difference? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Your body says, that looks like it might be okay, but it's actually not quite right. In fact, glucose and fructose are isomers, and your body still will take glucose over fructose. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the news about high fructose corn syrup. It is not the same as glucose, and your body treats it differently. It is a completely different chemical formula, or different structure, not a different formula.
You wouldn't trick us and put an isomer in it so they look the same, would you?
Yes, you would. An iso whatever, that's like a big of, yeah. Yeah.
And isotopes?
Isotopes have the same number of protons, different neutrons, and a different mass. You got it. Okay. Di, in terms of disaccharide, means two. Yeah, there's two sugars linked together here. Your two examples to know are sucrose and maltose. Sucrose is our table sugar. You'll notice it's made up of a glucose and a fructose. Hey, catch that chemical reaction. Is this an anabolic reaction or a catabolic reaction? Water is a product. That's one really good clue. Here's a second really good clue. Glucose is a monosaccharide. Monomer. Yep. Fructose is a monomer. Sucrose is a disaccharide. Okay, so 1 + 1 = 2, right? It is anabolic, yeah. Let me play with your brain for a minute. It's not neutralization, right? What was the general formula for neutralization reactions? Acid plus equals a
salt plus salt.
Do you see an acid or a base or a salt up here?
No.
Because all those words end in O-S-E, and that's a great clue that says, I am a sugar. Yeah. So great clue there. O-S-E says, I am a sugar. Okay, so glucose is made up of, sucrose is made up of glucose and fructose. You've also got another example listed there, maltose, which in fact is two glucose molecules. You like malted milk balls like Whoppers? That is maltose. If you like malted milkshakes, that's maltose. Okay, so we know sucrose is table sugar, and we know maltose makes up that malt flavoring. We finally get to the complex carbs, which are on the bottom of your page, and these complex carbs are called polysaccharides, meaning what?
Many
sugars, good. So you'll notice glycogen, cellulose, and starch are listed down there. These are all storage forms of excess sugar. Let's take glycogen first. Each one of these little six-sided rings is a glucose molecule. Lots and lots and lots of glucose is made up of glycogen molecule. Well, there's a hormone called insulin that takes your excess blood sugar to your liver and to your muscles and stores it there. And so you have about a 3-day storage supply of glycogen before it becomes stored as fat. So I want to make a point that this is not fat, not yet, but if you go to Krispy Kreme on Monday morning and you have a dozen donuts all by yourself and you don't work it off, by Friday, you're converting the glucose to glycogen to fat. So it's a permanent keep for you, right? So you've got 3 days to burn off your glycogen supplies before they get stored as fat.
That is great news.
Yeah.
3 days to burn
them. 3 days, yeah. If you're bad and you eat something you know you shouldn't, then 3 days work it off like crazy. Yeah.
That's great news.
Starch is not how we store extra sugar. Starch is how plants store extra sugar. And starch, of course, is again made from glucose molecules. You probably enjoy starchy foods. You know, they make us feel good, but they also add on the pounds if we don't burn them off. They include things like rice and potatoes, breads, whole grains, pastas. So the stuff that makes us feel full packs a lot of calories because there are lots of glucose molecules here. So if you want to run a marathon, what's your better selection? Glucose or starch? Yeah, starch, how come?
Doesn't burn off all the time.
Yeah, doesn't burn off. It's a lot of energy. It gives you a much longer burn supply. It's like putting a big log on a fire instead of a twig. The glucose is burning a twig. Boom, it's done. Okay? Cellulose is also a plant storage form of sugar, and this is how we put excess sugars into plant walls to make them more strong and firm. You know, corn kernels don't break down. You can check your poop in a day or so and see the corn kernels in there. You ever done that trick? Okay. Gross, right? She talked about poop in class. That's made up of cellulose, something we cannot break down. And so cellulose requires an enzyme we do not have called cellulase. So we unfortunately cannot break this one down. It moves through our bodies undigested. We call it fiber or roughage or insoluble fiber, because we can't break it down. It just simply moves through our digestive tracts. So cellulose is something, again, found in plants along with starch. Glycogen is found in animals. Catch that difference. Glycogen is in animals. Starch and cellulose are in plants. Cellulose and starch are plants, yeah. I'm a little behind. I need to kind of push through this chemistry stuff in class on Wednesday. Are you guys comfortable reading the organelles at home? Okay, there's a couple of organelle blanks I need to provide for you. I can go ahead and give those to you now. That is 31 and 32. Okay, on page 31, there's only one set of blanks at the very bottom for lysosome. These are the two blanks. On the next page, let's see, you've got a couple of blanks there near the top. just checking. Anybody still copying? Y'all good? Okay. At the top of your page there for mitochondria, you've got three blanks for the product side. Because we'll use that in 211 in part of our conversation there, and also in muscles in this course. Okay, and one more blank there for centrioles gives rise to cilia and flagella. I'm gonna flip screen as soon as she gets through copying. Anybody still using this screen? Y'all good? Centrioles give rise to cilia, C-I-L-I-A, and flagella. So if you can read that for me, then we'll work on wrapping up organic compounds, and we'll do some basic cell information come Wednesday.
You said make flashcards on the carbs. Are we just waiting on you? In terms of the polysaccharides and all that stuff, or examples of each other?
Examples, I'd put structure, like the building block is a monosaccharide. I'd put the function, and then for the examples, I'd put your list of things.
Structure,
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 structure,